right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. Yes, we are here this week talking more Survivor Edge of Extinction. I am Colin, and joining me is the New England Patriots of accents, Dom. Dom, how are you?
It's been an interesting week, but the one constant, at least most weeks, is that I get to come in here and talk with you, so very glad to get to do that today.
Do we get to hear anything about your interesting week? Because I certainly don't know why your week has been interesting. Do we get any kind of inside info?
You may do shortly, but does it count as you still being here if you don't record an episode? Like, you are temporally and physically there, right? You're just not saying anything?
I was actually out of town for... I mean, the issue last week is we had overlapping times where we were both out of town. But whatever. We're here this week. We're going to cover last week's episode as well. But it is good to be back. I know this has not been a season that has been blowing people's minds necessarily to this point, although more on that shortly for sure. But it is, after taking kind of the week off, I think pretty exciting for me to be back in here talking about this. It feels like it's been forever.
I'd like to think that both of us are the special guests this week.
Right, yeah. But actually, I mean, let me dive into something I just alluded to. I guess at the top of the show is a totally fine place to get into this, which is, I will say, through the first four episodes, obviously I had low expectations just based on the twist for, frankly, just months even leading up to the season premiere, long before actually seeing a single frame of this in action. But through the first four episodes, I have genuinely been enjoying this season. Have you been liking this just as a general season of Survivor so far?
It's fine. I'm not going to rage quit. I'm not going to complain too vigorously about it. It's not the catastrophe that seemed to be the flaw when we were discussing the possibilities for the season yet. Although part of that is that the one thing that seemed to make it so terrifying hasn't really had a chance to come into play yet. So stay tuned on that front, I suppose. But it's fine. It's not especially compelling. It's just fairly forgettable so far, I think.
Right. I think the Edge of Extinction so far has been cool for me. Seeing the people... frankly, seeing people react to being voted out and getting to confront the people that voted them out in the first place, now that we're seeing more and more people pile up.
I have to say, I think Reem is doing an awful lot of work there to make that as interesting as it is. Because if it was some of these more low-key personalities who, even if they were feeling a little bit perturbed to see or to have to spend time with all these people, wouldn't really give voice to that, Reem is just going off. And it's that the producers must have been thrilled when someone like Reem gets voted out, and now she is the queen of Edge of Extinction.
Right. What you don't want is like a Rachel Aiko is the example, I guess I'm going to go with, of like someone who's just kind of...
Wow.
What's that? Yeah, yeah. Someone who's just kind of like quiet and not really going out of their way to fit in, being that like mayor of the Edge of Extinction. Reem is the dream candidate. The dream spelled D-R-E-E-M candidate.
Yes, congratulations, we get it. But yeah, there is this alternate timeline where like Chris is there, but not with Reem. And it's like Chris and Eric, who apparently is a contestant on the show, although I'm still not fully convinced about that. Like Chris and Eric and, I don't know, Lauren or something. And it really would just be absolutely soporific. So the fact that we have Reem there gracing our screens for however long she lasts is a blessing, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully all 37 days or however long that lasts, and we can get her at the final tribal council, not even necessarily asking questions. I want to see Reem in there answering questions, winning that challenge and going to the end.
Yeah, so this is, I guess, the fundamental issue with Edge of Extinction for me, is that it's an interesting character study, and I love the premise behind it and some of the stuff that they're making them do, like where they have to go on this mighty trek up to the summit just to get basic supplies for the day. And I imagine as some of the stronger guys come there, then that duty will be leaped on them, but then they'll resent having to do that, and so you'll get some discussion around that. And just stuff like that is potentially very interesting. But I don't like the entire end game that all of this is working towards. I would almost like just a sideshow where we get to see them on Edge of Extinction without Edge of Extinction having a reason to exist, which I guess is why that can never happen in the
first
place.
Just force them to starve out there for the full 39 days for no reason. That's what the Survivor purists should really want.
It has been fun, and the cinematography as well has been kind of interesting too.
Yeah.
Where we in these I guess you still call them confessionals, we get these close-ups of their faces, and either chyrons only appear momentarily and they're different, and it just the entire ambience of it is very different, and so far it's refreshing. I don't know how quickly that welcome is going to be worn out, and if it's 7 episodes into the season, then the rest of the this might be a slog.
Right. I really have been enjoying, it seems like, some kind of experimental camera techniques that they've been employing, as far as I have noticed, at least.
I don't know how experimental it is to just put the camera close to their face.
For Survivor, this is like massively outside their range through the first 37 seasons.
Okay, but it's not like the camera team only just learned how to put cameras in different positions. It's like, well, I guess this makes sense because we have to do something different, right? To make the concept feel new and interesting.
I don't think so. I don't think there was any sense of we have to do something different. I think they're just trying it out, and it's been cool. The same way I would imagine, as we'll probably talk about later, assuming I don't forget to bring it up, the flashback that we saw in this latest episode. I'm guessing, you know, we saw the flashback with Dan and the Hidden Immunity Idol last season as well. It seems like that's something they are, as far as I can tell, just experimenting with. And if it becomes a staple, then that would be awesome.
Yeah, although I don't know what it says that it took them, 18 years now to experiment with stuff like that. You think in 50 years, if the show or TV in general is still a concept by that point, maybe they'll finally start getting around to the, you know, season 1, episode 1 genius tactics we've become spoiled on over the years.
Yeah, well, hang on. I don't want to get too far off the edge of extinction yet, and I do have that somewhere later on in the notes. I'm sure you will be happy to tell the audience when it comes up in the notes later on.
I haven't read the notes this week. I'm just going completely blind.
Oh, wow, okay. Loose definition of completely blind here. I would argue me seeing zero of your notes is the true completely blind, but that's neither here nor there. One question I had about Edge of Extinction is something you've referenced, and certainly a big concern of mine as well, is what this is building up towards, because I think it has been fun seeing the number of people on there get bigger, and I think it will get more entertaining as it starts looking more and more like, as I've described it before, like the island from Lost, essentially, like this community with no real purpose other than survival. I guess there was some purpose on that Lost island, but less so out here on Survivor. But this is all obviously building up towards someone re-entering the game at the merge and at Final 5 or Final 6 or so, somewhere in that neighborhood. And I am really concerned that essentially, regardless of how cool or how awesome the experimental techniques with the cameras are on Edge of Extinction, I think there's a strong chance that none of that's essentially going to matter once we see the end result.
So you think that if someone wins their way back in and then that person makes the finals, they're just guaranteed to win Redemption Island style? Or
no, not necessarily.
Is there a concern there?
Not necessarily. I just think the entire premise of someone re-entering the game on day 37, even if they are, you know, what are the various outcomes? Either they don't make it to the end and what was really the point, or they do make it to the end and it's potentially one of the most controversial winners, if not obviously the most controversial winner in the history of Survivor, and I don't know if any of those timelines are necessarily good, and I just feel like once we see it come back and either have a major impact or very little impact, it's going to deflate from however cool what we saw along the way was.
There's also the just basic problem that you and many others have highlighted of there could be someone in the game who truly intends to do their due diligence in casting their jury vote and wants to give everybody a fair hearing and really work through all the possibilities, and is literally unable to do that because, let's say, they were the second post-merge boot. They go to Edge of Extinction. They stay there. They endure all of the hardships. They make it to the final battle, duel, challenge, whatever it ends up being called. They get sent to the jury then, and now it's day 36. They haven't been to a tribal council since they were voted out, and any news they have from the game has been heavily filtered through the people who have just come to the Edge of Extinction, which I guess is a mirror image of what you get with Ponderosa anyway, but to a much more extreme extent. And they just don't have the information that, even if they want to cast a vote with some measure of objectivity, however desirable you think that is, they just can't do that anymore.
Right.
So that's, for as much as we are enjoying it now, it's because there is this train like hurtling towards the tracks, and we're just not prepared to deal with it, possibly.
Right. One element that I didn't do the math on until like episode one or two is something you just flagged up, which is the eventual jurors will not get to go to any of the tribal councils, tribal's council, up until like final four or so. They're just going to have to hear everything through word of mouth. And that to me just fundamentally seems so weird and brings me back to the question I feel like we've been asking ever since we first heard about this twist, which is at what point is this just fundamentally altering the entire premise of Survivor?
At this point, I would say.
Yeah.
that's the scary thing about all of this.
Yeah, well, one other thing I've been wondering about, it seems like now that some days have gone by and no one has quit yet, I think it's at least in the realm of possibility that we don't have anyone quit, at least before that first merge challenge, just because once you show up and there are already four or five, six people there, are you really going to be the first one to quit? I don't know how anyone's going to be comfortable kind of pulling that trigger unless they are just like in a horrible state mentally, which may happen to someone. But as of this hour, I might say my money would be on the under 0.5 quitters before the merge, and it would not blow me away anymore. As insane as it sounded to me, like in theory before seeing Edge of Extinction play out, I would not be completely shocked if we end up with a 15-person jury, if no one ever quits.
Dear God.
I don't think that would be... do you think that's impossible?
No, it's not. It's a very real possibility here. Do you have Wendy sticking it out the whole way? Like, if she were to get voted out next week, which I don't actually think is going to happen, by the way. I think she's in this for the long haul. We can get into that later on. But there are various people, maybe some left in the game, who, if they got there and they're faced with the prospect of... you know, they see six other people there who none of whom are going to quit, and they realize that to make it back in, I'm going to have to get through all of these people in some final contest. And if one of those people is Joe or someone like Chris or someone who you can tell is really good in challenges, or like Kelly, if she gets blindsided, like maybe it's more appealing to just raise that mask and go, knowing how bad the odds are. But then again, there is such a stigma against being that first person.
Exactly.
I'm not sure who would do it. Like, if you get there and within 3 days you're considering raising the mask and quitting, when like Reem has been there for 16 continuous days making everyone's life a living hell, then it's like it makes you look even weaker by comparison. So I don't think anyone's going to want to be the first. But I do think that if someone does quit, maybe that opens the floodgates and you see a few more people follow suit.
That's an interesting call that I think could potentially pan out for sure. I also think there may be an element if it takes long enough for someone to quit and they're deep enough into the game where I don't know how it works, but something we brought up, I think, in our premiere podcast was maybe the prize money goes in quit order rather than vote out order, and suddenly you get voted out on day 27. But if no one's quit yet, you're walking away with $3,000.
And they know that, presumably?
I would guess so, yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
I could see that being a factor. If that is how prize money is determined, that could be a major factor.
That is an interesting wrinkle, yeah. Because if you might think, I have a 0.0% chance of not just winning the game, but even just getting back into the game. But if I stick it out here for 10 more days and I can make $10,000 in the process, that's not a bad day at the office. Or I guess a bad week and a half at the office.
Right. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to potentially learn how all of that works once the season is over, but maybe they won't even be allowed to talk about it.
Yeah, which is going to make for a fun, an even more excruciating, like, deconstruction, or what am I trying to say here? Post-mortem after the season?
Yeah. Well, I guess we will potentially learn more about that later, but Dom, let's talk actually a little bit about someone you just brought up. I'm going to call the star, at least of these last couple episodes, if not of the entire season to this point. I think since we're covering two episodes, it's fine to just be talking in pretty general terms, and don't worry about chronology or anything to that effect. Weaving between the episodes is fine with me and hopefully fine with the audience. So I just want to have just kind of a general discussion about Wendy and the role that she has been playing within the season so far. Are you here for Wendy?
First of all, big Wendy. And
secondly,
yes, I am. She has really done She is literally carrying the season on her back so far, and we have her to thank for a lot of it.
Yeah, I agree that Wendy is, to this point, a big piece of the overall entertainment value of the season, but I don't think that's necessarily a knock on the rest of the cast. I think the kind of chicken saga that's eaten up a lot of the camp life over these last couple of episodes has just been... you know, kind of such a vacuum of airtime, and for understandable reasons, that the rest of the cast is kind of on the back burner. But I understand why they want to focus on someone like Wendy, who it seems is barely even out there to be playing Survivor in the conventional sense.
So maybe the scariest possibility is that everybody else is just playing what Aubrey called Kumbaya Survivor, where there just isn't that much interesting to focus on. And if their personalities aren't that dynamic, then you need something to fill that void. And maybe the only thing on offer is Wendy and Chekhov's chickens, I guess, if you want to call them that. And for as much as Wendy is this big personality and a very annoying personality to a lot of people, I could see if, let's say, she is destined for Final Three, but then when we get to the merge, some of these players come out of the woodwork, or she takes a back seat, or there isn't as much Wendy content that you get to focus on. Maybe now is the time when they're just going to front load all of that. So she becomes this wacky personality, but then becomes this quiet, dependable vote down the line.
I, at this point, do not know if I see that being the most likely scenario here for Wendy. When you were talking during the Edge of Extinction discussion about, you know, maybe Wendy will go on there and decide she doesn't have much of a chance of coming in or winning if she did, and she could be one of the people who quits. I, as things stand right now, frankly have a very hard time seeing Wendy getting voted out unless it's very soon. And even that, I think, would be somewhat of a surprise to me. I think if I were doing like a last longer draft out of the entire cast of this season, Wendy to me seems like she has the highest day 39 equity just in terms of losing finalist likelihood. It seems like Wendy's got to be standing out among the pack, right? In terms of people that everyone's got to be viewing as someone very worth considering bringing to Final Tribal Council.
Yeah, if you were bold enough to take her in a last longer at the start of the season, the first few weeks would have been terrifying for you, and you would still need to be on the edge of your seat maybe for the next 2 or 3 weeks, but then as soon as you hit the merge, you're golden. You're counting your money and thinking how you're going to spend it already.
Well, and actually, in thinking about it, this time last week, I am certain I would have said that my top two would have been Wendy and Rick, so take that with a grain of salt.
After this week, I think not to spoil the edit zone, but I think my number one is Wardog. So that's where my life is at right now. That's how my edging experience is going.
Yeah, I mean, Rick was still my number one up until about 6 minutes before he got voted out. So we'll get there. Point being, don't worry about our edgic takes if last season wasn't evidence enough for you. But Dom, I want to ask quickly about Wendy, what you think about the prospect of, has she already locked up a second appearance on Survivor?
No, I don't think so.
I think the only potential hang-up is Survivor not running long enough. I would feel like Wendy would be a huge front-runner to already be close to a lock if it seemed like there were going to be at least a few more seasons full of returnees.
I agree that recency bias is a guarantee to be there on the next All-Star season. I just don't know if Wendy is going to be the manifestation of that.
She may not be. I would just feel very good about making a bet on the prospect of Wendy 2.0 potentially becoming a thing. But
okay, my reservation there is that if we agree that there is some kind of big, like truly big All-Star season coming down the pipeline,
big Wendy All-Star season.
Maybe, let's hope. I don't think she's going to be in contention for that.
Right.
And then when the dust has settled from that, it's maybe going to be a few years before the next one. And at that point, even if she continues in this vein for the rest of the season, are people really going to remember Wendy? Like, that's a long time that she has to stick in people's minds.
I think if it was a few years from now and she showed up with that blue hair again and those antics and freeing the chickens, people would remember Wendy.
Maybe.
I think the same, especially after potentially an entire season of Wendy, I would say she would be one of the most memorable. But I do think actually, Dom, it does seem overwhelmingly likely at this point that season 40 is going to be some kind of mega all-star situation. But I was talking last week, or I guess it was two podcasts.
Hold up. I have a Wendy question for you. So is there anyone across any reality TV franchise you care to bring into the question who has the word big prefix on their name who isn't just a completely absurd human being?
Big Jeff?
I think absurd is being kind to him, frankly.
I think the cartoonishness of Jeff's personality has become greatly exaggerated over the years. When he went into
the
BB11 house, he was just a normal dude.
I don't mean completely cartoonish. I mean just over time, you're like, okay, this isn't a serious contender to win. They're not just, often not a serious human being. They're just there for some kind of comic value.
No, I mean, you do make a good point. There's not a lot of big fill-in-the-blanks that I can think of winning many of these seasons. But I don't think it's necessarily the biggest indicator that they're completely doomed. I think we've seen a lot of very successful big fill-in-the-blanks at least make deep runs, and I think Big Wendy could be the latest.
No nominative determinism going on there?
Yeah, no, I think it's the opposite, Dom. I feel like, you got your Big Jeff, Big Frank on Big Brother, Big Tom, and Big Ted during the early days of Survivor. I feel like big people are locked into at least Final Five.
Can you see yourself being a Big Colin at some point?
I think this time last year that would have been a little more fitting, but neither here nor there, Dom. I wanted to say...
interesting.
Okay.
Let's unpack that statement.
Let's not. All right. I wanted to get into what? Oh, I wanted to ask you about something that I thought was really interesting that when I talked to Akiva after episode 2, I think, he brought up about, we were talking about just the future of Survivor and with this possibility of this mega all-star season coming for 40 and what may be on the horizon after that. Keeve flagged up the possibility that Survivor may potentially just outlast the entire medium of like network television and may need to be picked up by something like a Hulu or whatever. But I was thinking to myself, Dom, assuming we do go past 40, if we want to be optimistic here, are we really going to get to season 44 or season 46 and not get to 50? It really seems to me like the magic number is 41. And if we hit 41, we will almost definitely hit 50 unless TV just dies.
Yeah, when you've already had several dozen seasons, it feels like any cancellation is going to come as a surprise. And there's no reason why it had to be now as opposed to 2 years ago or 2 years in the future. And I think it is going to come down to, as you often say, when Jeff gets bored and decides to move on to other things.
Yeah. I don't know if Jeff is even going to be the one getting bored and moving on at this point. It really seems like he's happy, at least as happy as he's been in a long time doing Survivor. And maybe that will fade a bit over time as they stay in Fiji forever and it's the same trip over and over. But for the moment, I'm not too concerned about Probst. I'm much more concerned about just TV no longer being financially sustainable for enough billionaires that they just shut the whole thing down. But Dom, actually, before we get too far into this week's episode, I don't want to taint this process. I want to get this...
I don't think we've got at all into this week's episode yet, but by all means.
Okay, I want to get to something that I had at the top of my notes as like an icebreaker for this week's podcast, but we've got to be 20 or 30 minutes late for that at this point. Dom, as you know, I genuinely and non-ironically find it immensely important to try to keep an ear to the ground on what the casuals are thinking about the current season of Survivor, because I recognize that these are episodes being made and seasons being themed not for people like us at all, but for the 99% of Survivor viewers who are not thinking about it beyond Wednesday at maybe 9:10 or 9:15 p.m. So fortunately, my friend Anna is a casual, and from time to time I get to get her opinions on things and really gauge what that kind of audience is thinking. And Dom gets to take a quiz on what casual Anna thinks. So Dom, it's time again for casual Anna thinks. Are you ready to play the game?
As ready as I'll ever be.
All right. So the way this week's game will work is as follows. This poll was conducted after episode 3, but very little changed after episode 4, so it still works today and is fine. I asked casual Anna after episode 3, name for me as many of the new players on this season as you can. The returnees do not count, and she ended up coming up with 5 newbie player names, Dom. And the way the game will work is if you can get 4 out of 5 or better, you win. And if you get less than that, you lose. So again, bear in mind, this was after episode 3 was the initial polling, but very little has changed.
All right, hit me.
No, you guess the names. I'm not going to just tell you the answer key.
So I also have to come up with people who are on this season? That itself is a challenge.
You're guessing who the casual fan remembers from the first 3 episodes.
Okay, I'm going to assume here that if I don't remember them, then she probably doesn't, although maybe that's a big assumption to make. So I'm going to say she remembers Wendy.
That is correct.
Okay, I'll say she remembers Rick, because if nothing else, because you never shut up about Rick.
2 for 2.
All right, so we have Wendy, Rick. I'll say Lauren, because I can see Anna sharing Lauren's adoration of Kelly Wentworth.
Dom, you were 3 for 3.
Okay, those are the easy ones. I feel like it gets a lot harder from here. So even just staying on that tribe, who else do we have? Edge of Extinction throws a wrinkle in this too, because these people are on there every episode now. So
these were active contestants. There will be a bonus question about Edge of Extinction later.
So active as of the end of this episode?
As of the end of episode 3.
Right, okay. Huh.
Rick obviously no longer active, but you already got that one.
Yeah. Well, let's go over to the other tribe, where basically no one has had any screen time. So I'm going to say the Julies and Julius of the world are out. Eric is out. Victoria is a maybe. I'm going to say no. Although she has a fairly like distinctive look as well. She's had a few confessionals, so I'm going to say she did get Victoria.
The perfect game is gone.
Oh, God. Huh. Well, now I feel if she didn't get Victoria, she's not going to get any of the others. So I'm going to say that's it. It's 3 out of however many were left.
Well, you have one guess remaining. If you get one of the other two, you win the game. And if you don't get one of the other two, you lose. So now is the time to think it through and put in a guess.
So there was Gavin and Ron.
We'll recap. So far, you have Rick, Wendy, and Lauren.
Yes.
Okay.
What are the rules here? What am I aiming for?
Getting the next name right is the entirety of the game at this point.
Did you tell me how many names there were in total?
I told you there were 5, and you needed to get 4 out of 5 in 5 guesses.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, now that you explain it that way. Well, the only other people I can think of are Gavin and Ron, and Gavin has been pretty low-key, so I'm going to say Ron is the next one.
Dom?
Yes?
You have won casual Anna thinks. Ron is her favorite player of the season. And I'm guessing a lot of people at home are wondering how you did not think she remembered the War Dog.
Oh, God.
Yeah, War Dog in particular is screaming at his radio right now.
This may be a Dr. Will thing if the target is so big that it's become invisible, and I've just been so oversaturated with War Dog that the very name has escaped my brain. But I you know how there were those TV shows where there's some minor character that gets introduced and they become so wildly popular that then they get their own spin-off, and then that spin-off eclipses the original show and they're the star of the franchise? I feel like that's what's happening here with casual Anna thinks, and I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, is she doing some broadcasting that we don't know about? No, I'm not saying she couldn't. I'm sure if she threw her hat into the ring, would be out of business overnight, but I think at least thus far we're safe just on her lack of caring about Survivor.
Well, we'll enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah. So, Dom, the bonus question, this was conducted at, like, 9:15 p.m. on the night episode 3 aired. So, as I presented her the question, I guess I did not specify, don't tell me the people that have been voted out. I just mean active contestants. And she did list one person who had been voted out to that point. Which of the three people who were on the Edge of Extinction at that point did Casual Anna remember?
It has to be Reem, right?
You'd think it would be Reem. It was not Reem.
Oh, come on. It's obviously Chris, isn't it?
It is Keith.
Oh, what? Okay.
It is Keith. I don't know how. I don't know how it works, but it was Keith.
So I figured Reem is the longest and the loudest of the people who were there, so she would make sense. But nothing ever makes sense. And if you're asking me the question, then it can't be Reem. And Chris is hot, so it's probably Chris, right? But then somehow she landed on Keith instead. As always, I am mystified by the way Casual Anna's mind works.
Yeah, and then her update after this episode, I asked if she got any new names this week, and she didn't, but she said she really likes the guy who had the chickens interrupt his confessional because he's really hot.
Well, that could be any one of them. Is that Rick?
That was Eric.
Ah, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, and incidentally, Eric, whose face I had not really seen in any of the episodes to this point, I remember, actually, Dom, you asking me when we were podcasting about the Barkley Marathons, do you know what Jared Campbell even looks like? And I said, yes, I do. He looks a lot like Eric, is the answer to your question. He looks a hell of a lot like Eric. So got to feel good about Eric as a potential winner just on the principle of looking like Jared Campbell, right?
Because he was smuggled in from a crossover episode?
No, because Jared Campbell, not known for losing things.
Yeah, but I'm not sure how this works, but looking like someone doesn't mean you just inherit all their qualities via osmosis.
Okay, well, as far as I'm concerned, it does. So,
oh, well, fair enough, then.
Deal with that, Draco Malfoy. So, okay, moving on, Dom. Let's talk, I guess, quickly about something that happened in Episode 3 that we haven't seen too much made of to this point, but I'm sure it will become a storyline once her tribe starts going back to votes again. Let's talk about Aubrey picking up her first career Hidden Immunity idol. She's someone who we talked about having potentially kind of a rough start here on this season, but I've heard a lot of people after this most recent episode, or I guess this was 2 weeks ago, feeling a lot better about Aubrey going forward. Where are you now on the state of Aubrey's game?
Yeah, that was a big week for Team Aubrey, and after an opening where it seemed like we were just getting game changers all over again, which maybe we're still getting, and not just in the way that Aubrey's being treated here. But she has sunk back into obscurity, kind of, in this episode. But that's always the question of, what are you meant to expect from someone who is a returning player, gives great confessionals, who is going to be relevant to the game in some way, whether or not she's actually in a good position or not, but who never actually has to go to tribal and figure out where she stands. Like, it would make sense if, given that she's been completely safe so far, maybe you can afford to just save all the Orby stuff for later when she actually legitimately is in danger or in control, one of the two, and just leave her out there for now. But then why not just use her while she's there? She's a great resource. And as we said, if Wendy and the chickens are the biggest storyline of the season, why not throw Aubrey a few more confessionals? Because you know that she's good for those. So I'm not really sure what to think of it so far.
Yeah, to me, I was one person who definitely did think Aubrey got off to a worse start than I was certainly hoping to see, at least the way it was shown on TV. But it does seem like going forward, there's not a huge reason to be concerned about Aubrey other than the general kind of target on returnees, but especially with this idol and with Big Wendy potentially as someone her tribe could very conceivably chop right away if they end up losing a challenge. I would still be forecasting at this point a better outlook for Aubrey than I was after the early episodes. I feel like it has been a big couple of weeks for Aubrey, and it's very possible, especially after everything we saw from Nick Wilson last season, and granted that was a David versus Goliath theme, but to have finally some stuff of winners not looking that great, I think means good things for Aubrey this season, basically, as far as potentially her rough start not necessarily being so bad if they're becoming more and more willing to show the winners in a more negative light.
Do you think this could be the spiritual successor, if you like, to the rough start that she had in Ko Rong, where initially she goes out there, she has this panic attack, it takes her a while to become acclimatized to the game, but then she recovers from that, she rebounds and goes on to become this dominant player who the people on the other side of the great edit wars of 2016 thought was going to win the season and was poised to do that. Or does that dynamic change when you are a returning player and you're expected to have a greater degree of, I guess, competence or self-assuredness right out of the gate?
I don't know that they are really ever putting a ton of thought into how does our edit or portrayal of this person this time around blend in with the other times that they've played. I'm sure they assume people are familiar with them as characters, but I don't think they would go to such a great extent as to like deliberately have it mirror her arc time, right? Like, you know, I really don't think as many similarities as we may be able to find between the early game in Ko Rong and the early game here and potentially evolving each time into a much more dominant player as the season goes on. I think that's more just a function of the way the story played out than any type
I'm not saying that they're setting up some deliberate trilogy story arc where this now is the fulfillment of what came two seasons ago. I'm just saying that back then she was able to sculpt that into an edit which many people thought was going to result in a win for her. And there's no obvious Michelle on the season so far. And we had Michelle locked in by episode five, was it, I think, that time around. And we are basically at or approaching episode five now. And I really don't see anyone who is in contention for that mantle. So I think the circumstances are pretty different. And I had the season narrowed down to any of the original Karma people or Aubrey, and that seems to be it. Like that's the distinction we're working with here.
I have a few more people in the mix, but I will come clean that my notes for the edit zone are as follows. This is all I have. Quote, last week Rick was my number one, so who fucking knows? Like I have no takes on who I think is really standing out above the pack in terms of the potential winner edit, but Aubrey would not blow me away.
Who would blow you away then? Because it feels like the edit this season is so much flatter, where even though the screen time is being given out incredibly disproportionately, it's very hard to find people who are amazing contenders or who are just obviously eliminated and there's no way they could possibly win, with the exception of Wendy, who I think we can safely count out on that front at least.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, actually, let's get into out of the people who are left. I guess we can dunchain a few of them potentially. And again, bear in mind, I have virtually no strong reads in any direction in a positive way for this season, but I would be comfortable saying Wendy will not be winning this season. And once again, I do not do this as much as I should because I don't want to be annoying and do it every single time. But to clarify, just because it's the first time we're doing it this season, the Dunchain is 100% intellectual property theft invented by a podcast that talks about sports called Pardon My Take, and it just works well for Survivor as well. The Dunchain means your season is over. You will not be winning. I would say Dunchain on Wendy. And at this point, the only one who's really jumping to mind is Julia, but I wouldn't be too far away from a few other people on that original yellow team.
Yeah, if you have to struggle to come up with their name to use as an example, they probably have the Dunchain on them already.
Well, there are some original yellow people that I think are in the mix, but I don't think it's going to necessarily jump out at us when one team is going to every single tribal council. Like, I think a big reason why everyone on the original blue team is drawing live for us and only a couple people on the original yellow team have really gotten much airtime and thus are realistically more likely to be in the mix by that principle. I think it's just because they've had no choice but to show us so much from that tribe that keeps losing, and so little with so much else going on between the challenges and Edge of Extinction and Tribal Council from the tribe, the people that have literally been immune every single time. I think it's going to be weird on any season where that's the case, especially if the eventual winner comes from the tribe that ends up just being safe forever. Why would you go? Why? What point is there in flagging them up so early?
So, not to keep invoking the grim specter of Game Changers, but do you recall what our edit takes were 3 or 4 episodes into that season?
I don't. I mean, not specifically 3 or 4 episodes at that point. I remember a thing or two about Brad Culpepper probably being said.
Right. I bring it up because that was another season where one tribe just avoided tribal for the first few episodes, and as a result, you still had this incredibly lopsided edit, but then it was almost like put through the lopsided again because of that. And so people like Troizan, for instance, were just non-existent. They were completely invisible from the show. And so when Sarah started to come into the mix as a potential winner, some of the discussion was filtered through that lens of, well, she didn't have to do anything for the first few weeks. So the fact that her edit was quiet on top of the low-key personality or bad confessionals stuff that got thrown around, that was one of the big talking points there. And I wonder if something similar might come into play this season.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, any season where one tribe is doing all of the losing and thus all of the meaningful scheming and plotting is going to have a heavy bias towards the people on that tribe. I don't know if there's really much the editors can be doing about that. But let's save the potential winner discussion from here out for the end of the show. I guess, Dom, let's talk a little bit about, before we get into the swap, just quickly, your thoughts on the Chris boot here. There was some discussion about this potentially being fancy play syndrome from particularly the War Dog, just feeling like Chris would be the sexy move rather than necessarily the most logical move. Did you have a strong take on that?
I was more confused than anything else. I haven't made it all the way to the end of your episode with Akiva, but I imagine you two spent quite some time trying to unpack that one as well.
Yeah, it's only been out for 2 weeks, so I forgive you.
I've been a busy man over the past fortnight or so.
Yeah, and it's only the first half of it is Survivor, so you're 40 minutes into the episode with Akiva, is what you're saying.
Look, I just really had to catch up on those challenge takes when they were fresh out of the oven.
Yeah, I could have seen this certainly going either way, and this is a spot where I am reserving judgment, frankly, until I hear probably postseason about more of the details, if I can even remember that this happened by the time this season is over, where I could absolutely see it being the case that it was tremendous fancy play syndrome on behalf of the rest of the tribe here. But it wouldn't blow me away if Chris was a much more obvious boot than the episode even led us to believe.
Yeah, this might be one of those cases where there was already a good reason that Chris had to go, and that it wasn't something that could really be conveyed on screen, or there was no possible reason why Chris had to go except for a few people, and so they had to just like weave something out of cloth and try and make it seem logical. But as presented, it seems like if you're on the David camp and you're struggling with this idea of, do we fire a shot at Kenny now or do we wait? If you vote out Chris, you're giving out one of the numbers that maybe could be on board with that. Maybe is, and we see him like take the idea and run back to different people, so maybe he's unreliable. But then once he's gone, you know for sure that you don't have the numbers to do that now, because War Dog is never going to be on board. So you're basically putting yourself into a minority position, and so if you have to go to Tribe again, which they did, although under different circumstances because it was post-swap, then one of you going seems like the logical thing that would happen. And then from Kelly's side of things, if Chris is coming to you and telling you that information, or I guess if you're War Dog in that case, then maybe it's like, well, if he can sell out someone else's plans to me, he can sell out my plans to other people. But in the short term, that seems like a great just thing you can rely on, right? If someone's right, coming to you and telling you everything you need to know.
My takeaway from the episode was, yeah, that it was probably kind of an overplay here from particularly the War Dog, when it seemed like Chris was super loyal to him. But one thing that I hadn't even really considered until it just kind of came up in passing is maybe there was more anticipation of a swap going on than they showed on the TV episode. Like, for whatever reason, they would have potentially kept Chris if they thought they would be sticking in this tribe for a while, but it wouldn't shock me if it was pretty common knowledge out there that a swap is definitely going to happen within the next two rounds, if not immediately.
Would you apply any kind of a cynical reasoning to that? Like, if it seems like one returning player in particular might be in a special amount of danger, then maybe there isn't going to be a swap, or... Because for me, this episode dispelled any conspiracy theories like that, where you would think they would want things to be mixed up, when instead we just got basically the exact same tribe placements, but also a third tribe with this just group of misfit toys.
So... what I would have potentially thought is, yeah, it would be a possibility that they would either swap early or delay a swap, depending on a certain returnee's position within the game, as I think has happened on the show before, pretty much without question. But I don't think, if I'm potentially picking up on what you're saying, I don't think there's any conceivable way that they would rig this swap so that people stay in their same teams, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, well, the one swap which is a historical question for this that no one seemed to want to acknowledge on the show is, of course, Rob and Amber, where there are a lot of accusations of foul play being thrown around there as well. But since that apparently never happened, then I guess there's nothing to suspect with this one either.
Actually, interesting point on that, because Steven made that observation on Twitter that I think it was Gavin who was asked or who made the comment like, whoa, this is the first time this has ever happened. And Steven was like, not so fast. This, you know, this exact thing happened to Amber during All Stars. And friend of the podcast, Albert, responded with what I thought was an excellent point that I haven't really heard anyone else make in Gavin's defense here, which is, if I'm Gavin, I would, even if he knows that, he should not say that about it having happened to Amber. He does not want to announce to the entire game, I know the entire history of every swap like the back of my hand.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's definitely in Gavin's range to know that and to know enough not to say it and to not blow his cover, because everyone knows that he's in that same mold, but not to at least remind them just how much he's on the ball. But my question is, do you think Jeff, like, if you quiz Jeff in that moment, would he be able to tell you, oh yeah, actually there was one very iconic example of this happening in the past? Or would that not even be in his memory either?
I suspect Jeff, if you had the afternoon or the morning before that swap draw happened, if you had said to Jeff on the beach in Fiji, hey, here's a trivia question about Survivor, what was the one swap where only one person switched tribes? I have faith in Jeff Probst to get the answer to that question. And generally speaking, the one big example that really stands out to me is the resurgence of the Tyler Perry idol, when people would suggest, including you, Dom, that Jeff forgot that they once had idols like that. That is completely impossible. People give Jeff so little credit in these kind of situations, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's because if he is doing this intentionally and not, you know, acting in a completely ahistorical fashion, it's very convincing. To listen to him, you would completely believe that this is revolutionary and nothing like this has ever been done before, if that's the line they're trying to sell you. And Jeff is a good salesman. And I almost want to believe more that it is sincere and he's just saying what he thinks than that he is this good at weaving a web of lies for some reason that isn't even apparent to me at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought a much bigger deal was made of that piece of trivia and that comment from Gavin or Jeff or whatever than necessarily needed to be made over the course of this week.
This fan base is just a pack of wild vultures. We just descend on anything that sounds remotely ambiguous and just tear it to pieces.
What did you think, though, of the way that this played out? Did you feel like we were robbed of a swap, or are you feeling like having essentially just a split into a third tribe, like a reverse dissolution? I don't even know what the term would be. It'd be like cells splitting and generating new cells, essentially. Two cells splitting into
What's that called?
I don't. What is that? God. Ah.
It's either meiosis or mitosis.
Yes, mitosis is what it is.
Okay, I know I have got the wrong one on that on a test before, but I'm not sure which one was the wrong one.
I've heard of mitosis, so that's what it is.
Okay, one of the two at least. But yeah, it does feel like you just kept the two drives in place and just like squeezed them, and then the remnants formed a third drive.
Are you cool with that? Is that interesting to you, or do you feel like we were essentially robbed of a swap?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a short answer there, but I guess for this tribe that we see go to tribal yet again, it seems especially egregious because we kind of know what's going to happen because that's all we've had to focus on for 3 weeks. Whereas on the other tribe, we didn't know what was happening to begin with, and so it doesn't feel the same sense of like stasis or continuity. It's just, well, maybe it's new, but anything is new because we just haven't had anything so far.
Yeah, I'm with you, by the way, that it feels to me like essentially being robbed of a swap. And do you think we could potentially go into two new tribes, or are we going to stay at three and then merge?
I don't think we're going to reshuffle again or like compress these tribes back into two. I think we're just sticking like this until the merge. And I imagine on this season in particular, when you have this extra twist on the side in Edge of Extinction, they don't want to complicate it even further, more than they have to.
Okay. So, yeah, I thought this new yellow tribe, which is essentially the old yellow tribe, had the most noteworthy kind of camp life scene to me, and it's less about their actual camp life and more about something we touched on a little earlier, but I want to get slightly more into that now, which is the scene where Joe tries to lock down Aurora and Ron, but Ron gives a confessional talking about how, well, actually 20 minutes ago I just had Julia going through Joe's bag to make sure he doesn't have an idol, and we get the flashback and it pops up 20 minutes earlier and we get the full replay of all of that going down. And love, of course, all of the like genius references that were made on Twitter and on podcasts and so forth. And I do genuinely think that it is at least a non-zero chance that so many people finally talking about and watching The Genius has permeated to the editing.
Okay, maybe this is going to land as an edgelord take for you, but I think this comparison is a fairly not off limits, off balance. What am I trying to say here?
What do you mean? What comparisons?
The Genius comparisons.
I'm not saying this is the same caliber of flashback.
Of course not, but
obviously, but what I'm saying is, I think it is within the realm of possibility that Survivor never would have gone to a Dan Rengering flashback last season, and this would not have been a flashback if there had not been so much vocal support and love for The Genius within the Survivor community.
Right. I would agree with that. I would also say that The Genius does not have a trademark or patent, one of the two, on the concept of like non-linear time. And
obviously not. It still counts as an influence.
Let me finish. And what we saw here, like on The Genius, what you often have is a sudden big reveal, right? And then the music drops and you rewind all the way back and you see the genesis of this thing that you thought you understood, but now what you're seeing here adds this whole new angle to it. With this, it was very different. It's like we basically saw what was happening, Ron told us what was happening, and then we just saw one set that led up to it. There was no like surprise, there was no turning of the tables. It was just here's a look into what happened that shed some light onto it, which is nice and is very welcome, and it certainly baby steps towards something bigger, but I don't think that it's categorically similar at all.
I think it is exactly what you just said. It is baby steps. To me, this is very little different. There is very little difference between this and what we saw either last week or 2 weeks ago, where they just used tricky angles to make it look like Victoria was privately bashing Joe, and then they pan out and Joe is right there. I think these baby steps into these kind of reveals are a good thing, and I want to say I think they don't need to go nearly to the same extent that The Genius does, like designing the entire story of each main match around some flashback changing everything. I don't need it to be a weekly staple every week on Survivor, but I do think that they are essentially, as we talked about earlier, experimenting with this, and I think these kind of mini flashbacks are like easing us into the possibility of using this on something bigger, and I am so here for that. I genuinely believe, just because I've seen how amazing it can be on other shows, that if Survivor is willing to embrace the flashback and can get the audience used to it, that is the future of Survivor. There is no doubt in my mind that if they want to go that route, that will absolutely work.
And as I said before, I completely co-sign all of your optimism. I just don't know if I share it.
Okay, and I don't think they will necessarily do that. I just think they, if they wanted to, it would be amazing. But yes. They may not do that. Then, understandably, I guess, you know, it's been on for 20 years. Let's not do anything insane to mess this up. Like, I don't know, have everyone who gets voted out stay on an island and never leave. But anyway, Dom, let's get into this challenge quickly between the three tribes, where there was a little controversy over Joe getting to solve the exact puzzle he's done on a previous season. Where did you land on that?
There was a controversy here?
A mini controversy. There was me doing some shady retweeting of, oh, isn't that convenient? But to be fair, I believe David Wright had gotten to do that ship's wheel puzzle that he couldn't do a couple weeks ago on his first season as well, and I did not complain about that, and I'm sure other returnees on Mix, I'm sure Ozzy or whatever, Boston Rob, got to do some puzzle that he'd already done before, and I didn't really care until it was Joe, so that's, I guess, mostly on me for being partial.
Maybe this is a bad take, more so than a hot one, but I almost care less when someone like Joe gets that advantage, because I feel like if it was everybody else had already played this puzzle before and Joe hadn't, he'd still be pretty good at it and have decent odds of winning the challenge by himself. So the fact that he goes from a 10 to an 11 feels less egregious to me than like a 6 going to a 9 just by having that experience of it.
I mean, that is like the trickle-down economics of challenge fairness, as far as I can tell.
I guess. I don't find myself caring about it either way, so I'm fully on board with whatever your conspiracy or theory is, though.
Thank you. I also thought it was weird that after Joe's team finished, they started openly rooting for the new Manu tribe, which just felt so odd, because I don't know that we'd ever really seen that before in a three-tribe situation on Survivor, but of course, once you think about it, it makes sense, because that is the entirety of their old tribe, as well as Wendy, right?
Yeah,
and of course they're rooting for Wendy.
Yes, who isn't?
Yeah, all right, anyway. The yellow team and the blue team end up taking that down, and the new green team is going to have to go to a vote here, which is the same group of people that we've seen at the first three tribals council as well, and it appears that Wentworth and Lauren are a duo, and Rick and David are a duo, and the War Dog has found himself once again kind of in the driver's seat deciding which way this vote is going to go. Dom, I'm going to ask a question that I did not anticipate asking this time last month. Through four episodes, is the War Dog obviously playing the best game so far?
Even if it's not obvious, maybe the answer is yes, and that's a truly terrifying prospect.
I feel like it's very hard to argue based on what we've seen from anyone else who either hasn't been to a vote.
Let me qualify this. Is it that he's playing the best game, or that just by being the swing vote and being put into the position that he's in, he's had to make these decisions, and therefore we see the narrative through his perspective, and we see him get to make these calls, which it doesn't seem like he's obviously bungled yet. So just by default, he gets anointed as the best player so far.
And so first and foremost, I will absolutely grant that he is the swing vote here, seemingly because he picked the right buff. And, you know, just anyone, not necessarily anyone, but a lot of people, between a Wentworth, Lauren, and David Rick kind of split would be equally capable at kind of calling the shots. And again, we did raise some questions about potentially the ideas behind voting Chris out. So there are some deductions that could at least potentially be made, or at least some reasons not to think he's just steamrolling everyone. But it really does seem like for someone that at least I will absolutely own, he was someone I expected to not be out there killing the social game necessarily to the extent that it seems like he absolutely has. It seems like, regardless of what's been going on, as his tribes keep constantly losing, pretty much everyone is going back to the war dog trying to get him on board.
So my question here is, who knows what from that plot that fell apart last week? Because the idea that we saw from David and Rick, and I think is definitely good practice, is we don't want to be implicated in this if it all goes to shit, which it clearly did ultimately. So what we're going to do instead is we will almost like enlist Chris to reach out to Wardog, and then Wardog is going to think this plan is Chris's idea, and if he's on board, then okay, great. David and Rick will be on board as well, because they're agreeable. They'll go along with anything. And if he's not, then Chris will be implicated as the guy who is being sneaky and trying to get one over on Kelly Wentworth again. And we saw that happen, but it's unclear if Wardog or Kelly sniffed out what was happening and realized that David and Rick had their hands in this to begin with, and that Chris was like this innocent victim who got caught in the crossfire here. So I guess knowing that if you're Wardog, you're going to side with either Kelly and Lauren or David and Rick. If you side with Kelly and Lauren, isn't there an argument for just going after David instead, even if you don't know that he was behind this plot before?
I would rather have David in there if I'm specifically the war dog, because I feel like he is much easier to argue down the line as a bigger threat than me than would be Rick.
Okay. All right. So if you're loyal to Kelly Wentworth, which it seems like he is, and if that's the value system that you're playing with, then if you know that David was behind this plot, then does that change the equation for you, or is the paramount thing just having more shields in place?
I think the paramount thing is having more shields in place, especially if I'm in there planning on being a power player for probably, it seems like in Wardog's mind, day one through day 39. David Wright is one of the least disposable people, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Well, what fate do you see in store for David then? Because if that new whatever they are tribe has to go back to tribal, then it feels like he's going to be in the hot seat, right?
I would guess so, but it may remain the case for the war dog, and he could potentially convince Wentworth that we would both be better off cutting Lauren and going in, getting David loyal to us and propping him up as a big target hitting the merge.
We see a hint of that in the preview, which of course means that is never going to happen. So sorry, David fans, we got to hope for that tribe to get its act together in the challenges.
Yeah.
But it's knowing what we know now, like seeing the outcome of this vote where David gets semi-blindsided by Rick going home, is there an argument for actually pulling the trigger the previous week and going after Kelly when you had the chance? Because it feels like now you can say he got screwed by the swap, but maybe there are several different outcomes here where just leaving these players in this other faction in the game is going to prove detrimental to you in the long run.
I would not, if I'm the war dog, I am not interested in taking out David or Kelly before the merge.
No. I mean, for David, did he make a mistake? Because we saw him this week say it's all about the timing. And it's an interesting reversal from his first time, where before he was very anxious and unsure if he was even worthy to be in the game, as we saw alluded to this episode. And maybe that manifested itself in his style of gameplay, where he was giving idols away and making these big, bold moves. And by the time we got to the early post-merge, he was universally hailed as the biggest threat to win and this massive power player. And now that he has proven himself and is just out there and he has this special status as a returnee, he's playing a lot more conservatively and he's coming up with these ideas that he wants to put into motion, but maybe not following through and actually pulling the trigger. So do you see any kind of a link there, or is this just him trying to respond to the circumstances here, but maybe not taking the shot when he needs to?
I think he is trying to just be as adaptable as possible. But I do think there is an element for David Wright, as badly as he may want Wentworth. I'm guessing that there has been some creative editing with just how passionate and immediate that desire to target her has been. And I think, honestly, for any of these returnees, that there may be an element of, at least during the early portion of the game, not wanting to be sending the message of it's fine to get rid of the returnees, right? Like, I think I'm trying to think of what a good example would be, and nothing's really jumping to mind, but I remember saying this about, I guess this is a Big Brother example, but about Jace being the week one HOH and tried people pitching backdoor plans to him. If you're like particularly Jace, I don't know if you want to be sent, or Kacer, I don't know if you want to be sending the message that backdooring people is such a fun plan. And similarly, if you're David Wright, I don't know if it's a great move to show that taking huge power shots against returnees early is a winning strategy.
Yeah, that all makes sense. And if you want to expand the psychological angle, I wonder if that anxiety is still there. But the first time it was, I don't want to fade into the shadows, right? I don't want people to just write me off the way they always do. Whereas now, maybe it manifests itself as, I'm coming in this as a returning player, as this high-profile guy, as this massive threat. I have to slink into the shadows for the sake of my own survival, and I'm terrified of putting myself out there the way that taking a shot at Kelly Wentworth right now is obviously going to do.
Yeah, I think part of that, I do think there is absolutely that concern about going for Wentworth, but I also think for David and probably for any one of these four returnees, the idea of ever hiding in the shadows has got to seem like fiction, right? There are no shadows when 14 people have never played before and you're one of four people who has.
Especially given that Joe apparently is barely on the season, so you can't even find him to hide behind.
Is Joe barely on this season? I feel like that's certainly not the narrative when you're out there playing. I'm sure
of course.
Joe's tribe keeps winning, the narrative in their minds is, oh my god, I'm just here on the Joe Waltzes to Victory season.
I'm just saying that in general, and especially coming off the first 10 minutes of that premiere, we have heard shockingly little either from Joe or about Joe, and I don't know how long that's going to continue.
Yeah, I mean, it can't go on for too much longer, right? I mean, there are no longer going to be tribal immunities at a certain point, and then I'm guessing once Joe is a candidate for elimination, his name's going to be getting thrown out a lot more frequently. But why would anyone ever throw Joe's name out there before he's actually up vulnerable, you know?
Yeah, and when he gets to the merge, there is a chance that he just rattles off the first four immunities again, and he's untouchable for a month in screen time. So maybe that's going to bolster his presence a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess let's one thing actually before we close on to go quickly go back to the War Dog, and this is going to be in the 2019 top 10 dumbest things I've gotten angry about year of the year list. Dumb. War Dog on his Chiron is listed as law school student, and maybe that's how they always list such people, but every single time it pops up, it irks me because it really seems like it should just say law student. He is a student at law school, but he is not studying law school. He is studying law, and he's a law student, not a law school student.
Do you remember what Cochran's Chiron said? At least the first time, and possibly the second too.
It said Harvard law student.
Okay, but he wasn't studying Harvard law. He was just studying law at Harvard, which I guess is kind of baked in there. So
he was Harvard law student. That is accurate. That one works.
Okay, and he is a and Rorlock is a student at a law school.
Right, but he's not studying law school.
Right, and Cochran wasn't studying Harvard law either.
Harvard is essentially an adjective here.
You don't need to lecture me about adjectives. I know how they work. You're right that this is by far the most pointless thing you have ever.
Okay, just not, for not, the record.
No. Not just in 2019. Across the entire scope of us knowing each other, I cannot recall a more pointless thing that you've got up in arms about.
I feel like whenever I talk about law or lawyers, it's just a recipe for disaster. So let's move on.
Yeah, you need to get one for yourself so that you're not implicated in any further scandals.
Exactly,
around.
Yeah. So, Dom, what else do you even have from this episode?
I don't really know. We could dive into the edit zone, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess the only other thing I had is just now that we see a little bit of Rick showing up, I guess we don't see him interact with the people yet until, like, the very last clip for, like, next time on Survivor or whatever. But I, to just go back to the very first thing that we were talking about and just seeing the people pile up on Edge of Extinction and trying to appreciate that novelty while it's still cool before it becomes a tremendous burden on the game, I don't see myself ever getting tired of Reem yelling at people as they show up. I think that's going to be awesome.
You could not ask for a better, like, crone haunting the Edge of Extinction, right? When someone gets out there, they've just been voted out, they're shell-shocked, and they're stunned but pleasantly surprised to learn that they're getting this new chance in the game, and then they stumble towards this barren shelter in the darkness, and they hear Reem just yelling at them, tearing them apart. Like, that, what better introduction could you have to that whole experience?
Reaming them? All right, let's move into the edit zone, and I don't think we have an updated bumper for the edit zone this season, so if you want to avoid our edit takes, probably smart of you, because you'll just get further away from what's going to eventually happen. But if you are going to be tuning out, of course Dom is on Twitter at DomHRV, and I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. You can email us domandcolin@gmail.com, and if you are into this sort of thing and you want more and you want to help support the show, we do weekly bonus episodes over at patreon.com/DomandColin, talking through classic CBS and other potentially in the future reality seasons. Right now in the middle of Survivor Fiji, which has been a ton of fun. So patreon.com/DomandColin for all that. Dom, let's start talking about the edit. Tune out now, everyone who doesn't care. And again, I will reference my note here. Is all it says is Rick was my number one, so who fucking knows? Where do we even begin with who's looking good as an eventual winner here, Dom?
It's the War Dog, baby. He's got it in the bag.
I hope so. Like, War Dog may genuinely be my number one, but again, Rick was my number one this time last week, so War Dog could also easily be the next person voted out, as far as I'm concerned.
Not to cross the streams here and bring all of these external clues into it, but someone who is as big of a hot mess as War Dog can be at times on social media, the fact that he is almost, like, shockingly competent in the scope of the game, is that has to be a good sign, right? Like, if there is, you know, if his personality is rough around the edges, we're not really seeing it yet.
No, but it reminds me the on-screen persona versus social media persona. A lot of Tony Vlachos, who was quite a capable Survivor player himself, and obviously not the only comparisons that have been made between Tony and the War Dog to this point, but to, I guess, be frank about what you're getting at, like, yeah, I would have thought that someone as borderline maniacal on Survivor Twitter as the War Dog has been would be in very rough shape to win, but it really does just seem like, at least to this point, not to set the bar impossibly high, but Tony Vlachos 2.0 on all fronts.
Maybe not on all fronts just yet, but certainly on the ones that matter for the edit zone. And looking at the broad scope of the season, it does feel like, do you agree with the basic premise that one of those Karma 5 or Aubrey potentially, although maybe even that's wishful thinking, that Karma 5 have to be the most prominent contenders, right? Just because we've had so much of them?
Well, I agree they are the most prominent contenders, but to kind of repeat what I was saying earlier in the podcast, I don't think there's much choice about that when they're the people going to literally every single vote for at least the first four rounds. They are always that group of people will always be the biggest screen presence, especially when there is essentially a fourth tribe that we have to deal with on the Edge of Extinction. There is just not enough screen time to go around. So while I am totally with you that the Kama people are much more developed and would be among my lead, I think any of them would be realistic winner candidates for me to this point, including David Wright, I think is still alive. It sounds like, unlike you, though, would have some people from that original Yellow Tribe still in the mix for me. For instance, I feel like what we have seen, albeit not a whole lot, but from Ron, I think, has been really strong to this point. And we haven't seen a lot from Gavin or from Eric, but what we have seen has been really strong, and there's been no need to show them.
That was not to cut you off this time, at least. But one thing actually that did stand out in the episode was when they got to that, what they thought was going to be a challenge, and they dropped their buffs and so on. In the lead up to that, we had one tribe getting your first look at the other tribe. Chris voted out of the last tribal council, and that was presented as, in Jeff's words, the biggest reaction he's ever seen to a vote out, which can't possibly be true.
Yeah,
and especially for someone, especially for someone as mostly unremarkable as Chris. But that was centered around Ron, right? And we had Ron like getting gently rebuked from the other tribe about just like making assumptions about what was going on over there. So I don't know if that's just Ron's personality, like he says what's on his mind, and sometimes that gets him in trouble. But I don't know if I'm meant to read anything into that at all.
Yeah, I mean, just anytime we are hearing a person on the Yellow Tribe's name used or seeing a confessional right. from them, they get points with me. One other factor, and this is, to go back to it, why I feel like David Wright's still going to be in the mix for me, on top of just, it does genuinely seem like he's been playing really solid overall, as far as I can tell. But one trend I noticed in just rewatching these last couple episodes for this podcast, and I don't even know if I would have picked up on this if I hadn't, you know, if like we'd done a regular one last week and I'd seen these weeks apart, but I did notice that I will read for you how the previously on copy begins for episodes 2, 3, and 4 respectively. This is the first word. These are the first words spoken in those episodes. Previously on Survivor, at the Kama tribe, the returning players were on the outs. At the Kama tribe, all eyes were on the returning players. At the Kama tribe, Aurora, Joe, and Aubrey were outcasts. Every single one of these starts with the tribe we're hearing nothing about and how screwed all the returnees are. And to go back to the idea of them potentially being more willing to make the eventual winners look like they were in some rough situations from time to time, it wouldn't blow me away if they are trying to insist to us that the returnees have had their backs up against the wall as they are not even encountering close votes.
To make that eventual triumph look that much more challenging.
Right.
Or challenging right. at all, even.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, to me, that's an argument for the Kama... Wait, hold on. I've been saying Kama this whole time and I meant the other tribe, right?
No, you've said Kama correctly a few times and Manu correct. You've said... you've been saying Kama for the blue tribe, yeah.
Right, okay.
I didn't know... This is why you do the Colin Stone method of... Ignore the tribe names, just stick with the colors, and nothing can go wrong.
Yeah, so strike that, reverse it. The Manu 5, right, and then you have the Kama... Okay, so I think the Kama returnees, so Joe and Aubrey, I think that maybe puts them back in the mix, although with Joe, if he were to win, how is this anything but just a coronation edit from start to finish?
Because that's... It's not 2012 anymore.
Yes, it is. That's what the people want.
yes, it is.
There is no good reason. It is 2012, and no one will tell me otherwise. There is no good reason to have Joe on the show for a third time in the first place, except to appease his hordes of fans out there who will lap up however much Joe they're given. They will gladly gorge themselves on Joe to their heart's content. And if you're a Survivor producer or editor, that is the easiest scenario in the world for you if Joe goes on to win a season. Like that is, I mean, that single-handedly could revive the franchise as much as I dread to say that.
So you think we would be getting Survivor Joverkill if this went his way?
I think we would be getting Survivor Overkill of Joe, yes. But yeah, it would just be like the idea of Purple Joe could not even enter your mind as a joke. It would not be possible to expunge the 10,000 scenes with Joe that we'd already have from your mind.
No, I agree with that. And I would guess that in general, if Joe were to go on to win this season, we would probably have seen a bit more from him. But I am certainly not done chaining Joe. Dom, are you done chaining Joe?
Not completely, but he is about ready to have that thrust upon him.
All right. Well, I'm feeling good, as I said, to quickly about some yellow team people. Ron, for sure, for me. And as I think I mentioned earlier, Ron, runaway, casual, and a favorite. So I could see Ron really resonating with more of the casual audience than he's potentially being given credit for by people like us. And
Hold up. Is Ron hot? Is there like a dad bod thing going on here? Or does she like him for his personality?
I think she likes his personality.
Ah, okay.
But I don't know. She is really shallow, so it may be his... is rockin' bod.
Could go either way.
Could go either way there. And I think I mentioned, I thought Gavin, what little we've seen, has been good, and I know he's gotten some personal content. Have you made anything one way or the other of Aurora? It seems like we've seen a bit from her, but it's not particularly been the greatest.
Yeah, I really wish we could. And she is the person who would have been, I believe, if we'd done a preseason podcast, she definitely would have been the Colin Stone, whatever the politically correct term for it is in 2019, memorial something of the season. Like, she, you would have been fixated on her, and I guess it's to your credit that you avoided that commitment and so didn't have to get yourself tangled in that web.
That is a bold call.
Is it correct?
I mean, any season that Kelly Wentworth is on is going to be tough competition.
Okay, Kelly Wentworth aside.
I mean, I was advocating on a previous podcast for Wentworth to get divorced, so I don't know if anyone's topping that.
Well, we'll see how well that ages, but in any case, so she is exactly the type, like Allison last season, who people want to be the preseason favorite, and they seem like they have all the qualities to do it, but then it becomes abundantly clear, just based on the edit in those first few episodes, that they've dropped off the map, and I fear that that's happened to Aurora and to several other people on this tribe. Like, I do think Gavin is still in with a chance. Gonna want to hear a bit more from him soon, or just really hear anything from him soon, but like Eric, for instance, right? Just that's not happening. The Julies and Julias of the world, who both seem great, certainly on Twitter at least, and from what little we see of them on the show, they just haven't had a chance to breathe yet. So yeah, outside of a few players, that tiny handful, I think they're all dead to rights.
Okay. It is crossing my mind that we still haven't drafted this season. Do we want to do a must lose draft this week, or should we do it off air and then go through it some other time?
Let's do it off air.
Okay, we'll do it. That will be resolved on a future podcast. It is currently 1:45 in the morning, so I think that is a fine call at this point. Anything else, Dom, that you wanted to get to?
No, I'm all good for this week.
All right, so once again, he is on Twitter, at DomHRV. Instagram as well, if you're into that sort of thing. I am purely on Twitter, at Colin Stone, and DomandColin at gmail.com if you want to email the show. Thank you so much for tuning us in. I am sure we will be back next week breaking down another exciting episode of Survivor: Edge of Extinction. We'll talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.